type. Our topic for tonight is the stinking maneuver, or the dirty trick, or Hatargil HaMasriach, which was the ugliest moment in Israeli political history. It happened in between March and April of 1990. So we left off last time with the 1988 election, and an election which led to very close results, but one in which the Likud party won by a vote of 40 to 39, and they had a coalition that could have been a right religious coalition of 65 members, and yet Yitzhak Shamir chose to go the route of a national unity government with the Labor Party and have a very expansive coalition, which at a high point had 97 members. The reasons why he did that, I think we touched upon last time, but I'll just refresh everyone's memory. It's that Israel was in a very precarious position internationally late in 1988. The United States had recognized the PLO and was pushing for some kind of a rapprochement or the beginnings of a peace process between Israel and Arafat. A hard right government would have, of course, refused to move the ball forward on peace, and would have put the prime minister in the crosshairs of the American administration, as would happen anyway. But it would be even worse if his partners were far-right settler types rather than Shimon Peres and the Labor Party. So he wanted to have a more moderate face to his government and therefore be treated more respectfully on the world stage. Also, a far-right government would have insisted upon a massive settlement drive in the West Bank, and he would not have been able to refuse it, Shamir. Whereas a national unity government, together with the Labor Party as a senior member of the coalition, would of course insist upon no building of so-called political settlements, but rather only the expansion of security settlements in areas which Israel foresees retaining in any future agreement. So Shamir, even though he's a hardliner himself, he understands the difficulty that he'd be imposing upon himself if he only had rightist members to his coalition. Also, he didn't want to further alienate diaspora Jews, and a right religious coalition would have meant tinkering with the laws in favor of orthodoxy on matters of religion and state. So it helps to have the Avodah Party, the Labor Party, in the coalition to blunt that problem. And lastly, but not in any way the least, by having the Labor Party in the coalition as a senior member, it was an opportunity to give the defense portfolio to Yitzhak Rabin, someone Shamir got along with reasonably well, and keep it out of the hands of Ariel Sharon, whom Shamir did not get along with very well. Okay, so these are all reasons why the coalition was created. But it's going to be hard to sustain itself since the viewpoint of the two major components of that coalition differ substantially on matters of the peace process and territorial compromise. So something's got to give here. Well, when the coalition was put together, there was an arrangement that matters of foreign affairs and defense would be decided by a quorum of four. And those four would be the Prime Minister Shamir, the Defense Minister Rabin, the Foreign Minister Moshe Arons, and the Finance Minister Shimon Peres. Now, why was Shimon Peres made the Finance Minister? After all, Shimon Peres made a career out of being involved in matters of defense and foreign affairs. Finance wasn't his bag. Well, the answer is, he didn't have the clout at this point to insist upon either of the other two portfolios, foreign or defense, because he's the loser in this election, and beggars can't be choosers. Also, he had an interest temporarily, at least, in taking the finance portfolio because the Labor Party and the Histadrut and the whole left movement in Israel was in danger of financial collapse. Many of the institutions that had been built up over the previous six decades by Labor Zionism were at the brink of insolvency.
Kibbutzim.
And the kibbutzim, yes, and many of them had to go change their style and become for-profit corporations or whatever in the 1990s because by the late 80s they were financially unviable. Well, that's what the one motivation Peres had in taking that portfolio. Of course, it comes with the downside that if you implement policies people don't like and is financially disadvantageous to members of the electorate, they'll hate your guts and they'll never vote for you again. It's the finance portfolio is always a double-edged sword. Okay. Well, there was a deal made between Shamir and Perez, in which Shamir forced Perez to promise him that he would not try to undermine the coalition by appealing to the minority members of the coalition, the minor parties, to, behind anyone's back, make a side deal and turn the government upside down in favor of a labor government. Now, Perez made this promise and then proceeded to violate it from day one. That from the first moment, late in 1988, all through until the spring of 1990, Perez was leaning on the religious parties to turn their back on the Likud and prop up labor without new elections, just to create a new government without new elections led by Perez and the Labor Party. And he almost got away with it. Okay, so this was something that Shamir was concerned about and said, you don't do this, but Perez did it anyway.
What did he do to entice the right wing?
Oh, we're going to see. He offered, or supposedly pretended to offer, the finance ministry to the one man who should never have it, Aryeh Deri. Putting a corrupt man with a thief with his hand in the treasury. Okay, it's about as bad as it gets. So, Perez was the tireless underminer. That's what Rabin called him, and he would go on trips abroad as finance minister that only had a fig leaf cover of financial matters related to it, when really it was to conduct foreign affairs. He was the shadow foreign minister while actually functioning in the government, in the cabinet. Something you shouldn't do, but he did. Okay. So the Likud had its princes. Its princes, meaning its younger generation, whose fathers, many of whom were members of Herut, the old revisionist guard. And these were Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, whose father was Benzion Netanyahu. Benny Begin, whose father was Menachem Begin. Ehud Olmert, Dan Meridor, Roni Milo, Uzi Landau. Almost all of whom had fathers who were prominent revisionists back in the pre-state era. And these fellows are looking at Yitzhak Shamir, and for that matter Moshe Ahrens, as being older gentlemen whose time is sort of running out. And this is going to be Shamir's last hurrah. And they want to be the face of the party. They're exciting, fresh faces. And they believe they can win elections going forward. And maybe they will. And in fact, Netanyahu, of course, does many times over. Does the Labor Party have something similar? Not really. Labor has Rabin and Perez at the top. Perez and Rabin at the top. And a bunch of others, most of whom are quite dovish. Because in 1988, Labor ran a very dovish campaign. So that's who's on the next madrega down, the next step down the food chain. So who were the opposition to this government? The formal opposition hardly existed. The formal opposition were the communists, the Arabs, Shulamit Aloni, and the crazy left-wingers. But in the government itself, there was a lot of opposition. So who? Well, first of all, within the Likud, Shamir's the boss. Who doesn't like the fact that he's the boss? The guys who ran against him and didn't win. Notably, David Levy, the butt of everybody's joke, and Ariel Sharon. What happens is, both of them, who thought they deserved juicy portfolios in the cabinet, got next to nothing. Levy got the housing portfolio, something he had had since 1979. He thought he would become foreign minister, which he would later in life, but not then. And Sharon was given industry and trade. What did he want? The defense. He thinks he's the big boss. So they're very, very disgruntled. Why were they sidelined? Because who did Shamir prefer? He preferred people who had ties to the old revisionist Irgun and Lehi crowd, meaning the guys who were terrorists and blowing up the King David Hotel back in the 40s. In the 1980s, they should run the country. And anybody who wasn't from that group, you're going to get minor jobs, not the big jobs. The next layer of opposition was from the liberals. The liberals who agreed to disappear. The Liberal Party in Israel disappeared in 1988. It folded into the Likud. It was a component of the Likud, but it folded completely into it and ceased to have an independent identity. Yet they were not always so hawkish on matters of defense, and they were not always so populist on matters of the economy. They were more like upper middle class rich folks who wanted private enterprise and not high taxes. So Yitzhak Modai, who had been the finance minister previously, he was Bregis with Shamir, and later would depart from the Likud party. So he forms an alliance with Sharon and Levy to be an internal opposition within Likud, just to annoy the prime minister, to bug him at every turn. The third layer of opposition in the government was the Aguda. Now, why is the Aguda Bregis with Yitzhak Shamir? The answer is, they thought they were going to get a lot in this coalition deal before labor was introduced into the equation. When Likud needs the religious parties and must have them, so you can blackmail the future prime minister into giving you all sorts of goodies, positions as chairman of Knesset committees, deputy minister of this, deputy minister of that, money for the yeshiva, money for the mikveh, for the eruv, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden, they were irrelevant because labor came in and it was a massive coalition. So the Aguda from day one felt cheated and was gravitating further and further towards the Labor Party, looking to escape the coalition, and in late 1989, they left. They just decided we're no longer part of this, the coalition, we're in the opposition. Moreover, the Aguda has a more moderate position on matters of settlements and war and peace than does the Likud, because non-Zionist and not ideologically driven for Eretz Yisrael. So these were elements of opposition in the government aside from labor. But labor was the main source of opposition. Rabin got along with Shamir more than Rabin got along with Peres. So Rabin had an interest in preserving this national unity government. In fact, it was his idea in the first place. It got him the job as defense minister. It's what he wanted. He felt there needed to be a solid core, a big group to govern the country. Peres, of course, didn't like it at all. He wanted to bolt as soon as possible, as soon as it would become viable to have a left-wing government. And in 1990, he would think it's possible. But moreover, Rabin and Shamir, although they disagree about territorial compromise, they agree about no Palestinian state, about the Jordan River being the security border of Israel, and the maintaining of security settlements. They disagreed only over whether at some point in time there could be territorial compromise, which if it isn't now, then there's no need to fight about anything. And it isn't now. In 1988-1990, is anyone thinking about giving land to the PLO? Yeah, the Meshuggahs in the far left, but not Yitzhak Rabin and not Yitzhak Shamir. So they got along quite well, despite being of different parties and of different political orientation. Okay. So Israel put forth a peace proposal in 1989, which has been long forgotten by history because it's been overtaken by events. On May 14th, 1989, Israel put forth its idea of autonomy for the Palestinians in parts of the territories and for municipal elections in those cities. Well, why did America not put forth a proposal? Now you have the Trump proposal, the Kushner proposal, whatever it's called. Why did America, under Bush and Baker, not put forth their own proposal? Why did they wait for the Israelis? Because historically, American proposals always fell flat. This was true about Rogers in 1969, William Rogers. It was true about the Brookings proposal, which was for Carter in 1977. It was true about Reagan's proposal in 1982. American administrations, when they offer something, it never goes anywhere. But if the locals themselves come up with an idea, maybe it has some possibility for success. Now, both the Americans and the Israelis look to the Camp David Accords as a paradigm for future peacemaking. But each one looked at it in a different way. America wanted a repeat of the Begin-Sadat Grand Agreement, except that the players would be different. Instead of Begin and Sadat, it would be Shamir or Peres and Yasser Arafat. Okay? So the two parties come together with maybe a little bit of American intervention, but not much, and they come with a grand deal. The Israelis said, oh no, we think the Camp David Agreement is a paradigm for future success. But what does the Camp David agreement actually say? It said peace between Israel and Egypt, and the relinquishing of the Sinai, and autonomy for the Palestinians in the territories. Well, let's give autonomy to Palestinians in the territories. No Palestinian state, no relinquishing of security control over anything, but autonomy for the Arabs in the territories. Okay, so that was Shamir's idea. Well, the Americans and the Egyptians, trying to push this ball forward, meet with members of the Israeli government to try to advance the process. But they meet separately with Likud representatives and labor representatives. That's not supposed to happen. There's supposed to be one government at any one time. You know, there's only one president in America at any one time up until noon on January 20th, okay? And you can't overlap in even the slightest, all right, by a hair's breadth. So there's only one regime at any one time. You can't talk to this party and that party both in a coalition and think you're going to get a different outcome. So this was not a smart move. James Baker, Hosni Mubarak put forth a 10-point proposal about how to proceed with negotiations on the Palestinian front. Baker put forth a 5-point proposal, and Shamir rejected Baker's 5 points. Why? Well, because he was an obstructionist. Bottom line, Shamir was an obstructionist. And America was not happy. Israeli-American relations reached a low point late 89, early 1990. And the Americans threatened certain retaliatory measures against Israel over their obstructionism. What were those measures? So first of all, the exposure of Israeli and South African military cooperation over nuclear matters, exposure of Israel's internal nuclear secrets, threats by Bob Dole to cut off financial aid, and a statement by President Bush that East Jerusalem Jewish housing has the same legal status as that of Jewish housing in the rest of the West Bank, meaning no distinction made between municipal Jerusalem and Male Adumim or Ariel, but they're all the same. Okay. So, that's not very good. Not good for the Jews. By the way, you notice there's a partisan divide here. I didn't mention any Democrats doing anything bad to the Jews, only the Republicans. And later, James Baker would infamously use a foul word in saying, blank the Jews, they won't vote for us anyway. Who claimed that is what he said? Mayor Ed Koch. So again, it's a Democrat, the Democrat Jewish mayor of New York, friend of Israel, quoting a Republican member of the cabinet about how the Jews be damned.
In the Rogers plan, those 5 points, what really presented itself as being advantageous to Israel?
All right, so I'll tell you what was disadvantageous. The two biggest problems that Shamir had, and which he tried to use internally in Israel to say, I'm just defending general Israeli interests, not Likud partisanship, not right-wing ideologue, but rather, I'm an Israeli and I think this is bad for Israel. The 2 points were that in Arab elections in the territories, it was assumed that the residents of East Jerusalem would be allowed to vote. Now, what does that mean? It means that East Jerusalem isn't part of Israel. It's part of the territories. And that was unacceptable at that time across the Israeli consensus, not just the Likud position. The other was that deported Palestinians, meaning PLO terrorists, possibly even with blood on their hands, could be involved in these negotiations. And that was a no-go for Shamir and for many others. So he said, listen, these points are not satisfactory for us. We're going to reject them. All right.
Was this the point of the non-guarantee of Israel bonds?
Oh, you mean loan guarantees?
Yeah.
We're going to get to that shortly. Very, very shortly. Yeah. Okay. And that's about a year later, after the Gulf War. So the State Department realized that they could influence domestic Israeli politics by pushing their thumb on one side of the scale. And they would do so heavily in favor of the Labor Party, thinking that a Peres government would be much more amenable to this process going forward than would Shamir and the Likud. So they do whatever they can to mix themselves into domestic affairs. Exactly how, we don't have to go into now. But Peres insisted that the government support the Baker plan. Shamir said no. Shamir wanted a united front of opposition to the Baker Plan and come up with something else, an alternative, and Peres refused. And so therefore, on March 10th, at a very contentious cabinet meeting, March 10th, 1990, Peres and the labor ministers storm out, and they say, we can't deal with this anymore. So what does Shamir do? He fires Shimon Peres as finance minister. Instinctively, what do the other labor ministers do? Resign. Now, the fact that they resign is very important because, as it turned out, there was a vote of no confidence scheduled in the Knesset, put forth by Shulamit Aloni and Ratz, that was going to be 3 days later, or 4 days later, that very week. And that no confidence vote, if it were to be successful, would mean that those resignations of the Labour Party ministers would go into effect, and the caretaker government that would survive for the next bunch of months would be exclusively Likud. So it was a trick, and Labour fell for it. They sued in the Supreme Court and lost. And ultimately, the caretaker government lasted for a good 4 months or longer, and it was an exclusively Likud government. But these things happen. Okay, so how is it that a no-confidence measure was able to pass? It had never happened in the history of the State of Israel. In 1990, Israel was a 42-year-old democracy. They had never had a successful vote of no-confidence. What happened here? Well, the 39 members of Labour are, of course, all going to vote for no confidence. But that's not enough to get to 60, and you need 60 to oust the government. So the answer is that Shimon Peres was working over the religious parties and trying to get them to support him. And he was successful, at least temporarily. What was the logic of all this? Well, the logic, which was as true in 1990 as it is true in 2019, is that if the left side of the aisle wants to have power in Israel, they have to bust up the right religious coalition. Today, 30 years later, it seems like a difficult thing for that to ever happen. Will the likes of Yair Lapid or Benny Gantz ever bust up the right religious coalition? I don't know. They could try, but they didn't try this time. That's why they lost. But in 1990, Peres thought it was possible. Why? Few reasons. Number one, historically, there was a labor religious coalition. The Maftal and the Mapai, for a half a century, cooperated with each other in the pre-state era and in the early years of the state. Now, that cooperation broke down in the late 70s because, number one, Menachem Begin won an election, and because the Maftal was becoming more right-wing on territorial issues. Okay, granted, it fell apart. But for a long time, labor Zionism and religious Zionism could coexist under one big tent. So what did Peres think was possible? If I can't have a coalition, both in the literal sense of a governing coalition and more philosophically, if I can't have it with the Mafdal, with the National Religious Party anymore, because they're a bunch of settler types, I can have it with the Haredim. After all, the Haredim love me. I'm Shimon Peres. And by the way, they do. Shimon Peres was well-liked outside of Rav Shach, who we'll speak about in a second. Rav Avadya Yosef and Shimon Peres always got along. And other members of the Aguda historically had a decent working relationship with Shimon Peres. He was respectful of religion. He was not a Tommy Lapid type, not even a Yitzhak Rabin type who would smoke on Yom Kippur. Peres had a certain respect for the religion of his grandfather. All right. Well, he thinks he can pull it off. What else has he going for him? Number one, the Aguda was angry with Likud, and they had already left the government. So they're going to vote in favor of no confidence. Who else do you need? You need Degel HaTorah, and you need Shas. Well, Degel HaTorah should be an easy sell. That's the Misnagdim, the breakaway from the Aguda. Why should it be an easy sell? Because Degel HaTorah is led by Rav Shach, and Rav Shach is a big anti-Zionist, and doesn't believe in Jewish sovereignty as being the solution to the Jewish problem. And therefore, he believes that the territories should be given back to the Arabs.
Did he really?
Yes, absolutely. He was against war making and was very conciliatory on matters of peace. Extremely so. I would argue inappropriately so, even. Therefore, what kind of government would he want? Likud or Labour? Well, he would want a left side of the aisle government. What about Shas? So the Shas voters are mostly right of center Sephardim. who don't like Arabs and love the land of Israel and don't want to give it away. But Shas's leaders are Rabbi Ovadia Yosef and Aryeh Deri, both of whom were quite dovish and were in favor of territorial compromise and believed that Pikuach Nefesh overrides Eretz Israel. So, with all these considerations in play, Peres could reasonably conclude that he could have a government with the Mapam, you know, the far left, with Shas, Aguda, Degel HaTorah, Shinui, and the quiet support of the Arab parties as a blocking mechanism against the right-wing government and the creation of a minority left-wing government. That's what he thought. So it comes to the vote, and it was a success, 60-55. The government was overthrown. Shas abstained. They didn't vote against, but they abstained, which was good enough to topple the regime. So now Peres has 36 days to form a government. That President Herzog, Chaim Herzog, hands him the mandate. Go ahead, form your government. Well, he thought he had it all locked up. Comes April 11th, and there's going to be a signing ceremony. And the new government was going to be introduced and sworn in. And what happens? It collapses at the last hour. It turned out that several members of this grand religious left coalition had lied. They had not actually signed the papers, including one of them, Avram Verdiger, who took a pen over the paperwork and waved it over the paper but didn't actually sign the paper. So he had been a member of the Aguda, and I'll explain in a second. What happened was there were two members, Verdiger and Eliezer Mizrahi. They were both Chabadniks. And the Rebbe called in from Crown Heights and said, do not let Shimon Peres become prime minister. Now, why not? Because who are the biggest Zionists? The Lubavitch. Who are the biggest anti-Zionists? The Lubavitch. I've made this point before. It's a split personality thing. As a formal political matter, an ideological matter, they're staunchly anti-Zionist. But when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, no compromise with the Arabs at all. Not an inch. Not a millimeter. No, they wouldn't have to, and they wouldn't, in fact. But they would be outside partners that would prevent the other side from being able to form a government.
But they wouldn't sign once
you did. No, and you don't need a majority government. You just need to not be undermined by a majority. You can have a 50-some-odd member government, which has happened briefly, as long as you have outside partners who are willing to remain outside partners. Okay, so the Lubavitcher Rebbe stepped in and prevented the Aguda from joining a left-wing government. What else happened? Rav Shach stepped in. And Rav Shach, although he's a left-winger when it comes to the territories, Rav Shach was a virulent hater of labor Zionism. And he gave a speech at Yad Eliyahu Stadium on March 26, 1990, which goes down in Jewish history as the hares and pig speech, or the rabbit and pig speech, in which he said that labor Zionism destroyed Judaism for the masses and fed people rabbits and pig at the kibbutz, and that the kibbutz grandchildren today don't even know what Shabbos or Yom Kippur is. It was a very famous speech where he gave with passion, with fire, and sadly it's not available on YouTube. There is video of it, but I couldn't download it to my phone, otherwise I'd show it to you tonight. And he really overturned the whole process, because by refusing to cooperate with labor in creating a left-wing government, despite his affinity for their policy on matters of the territories, he made it impossible for Peres to go forward, because Rav Shach not only controlled the Degel HaTorah, which was two seats, Rav Shach really also controlled Shas. Because as much as Rabbi Ovadia Yosef liked to think of himself as the boss, in the beginning years he was beholden to Rav Shach. Now, there's also another factor, and that is Shas could not ignore its own electorate. If Shas had thrown in with Peres in an avowedly left-wing regime against the wishes of its voters, it ran the risk of losing thousands of votes in the next go-around. So, yes, Rabbi Ovadia and Deri might be doves, but if your average Chaim Yankel or Chaim Yaakov is not a dove, then you can't do this. Okay, so the whole process failed. Now what happens? Now the president has to go back to Yitzhak Shamir and say, now it's your turn. So Herzog was up to his eyeballs in misery here, because this was the sixth time in 7 years as president of the state that he had had to turn to someone and ask them to form a coalition. Now, usually it's once every 4 years, every election cycle. So in a seven-year span, it should have been twice, 84 and 88. Now this is the seventh time over, because of the quirks of the rotation the previous time, that Herzog has to do. So he says, he makes a big pronouncement and says, we need electoral reform. Which, by the way, had been ongoing a quest for electoral reform ever since the days of David Ben-Gurion. But for the president of the state to make that comment, it was seen as treading dangerously to the line. Because what is the president of Israel? It's a ceremonial position. He's not supposed to be advocating policy. But he was so fed up with the failures of the existing system that he says, we got to do something about this. Okay. Well, the mandate is back to Shamir. So Shamir had a problem. He can't get to 61 seats unless he wins back all the religious parties, which he's able to do with effectively bribery. But he also needs one member of the Likud who had defected to the Labor Party to come back. And this was Avraham Sharir, who was a member of the liberal wing of the Likud party and defected to Labor. And he famously, Shamir said in a televised plea, Abrasha, come home, Chazor Abaita. Abrasha was the nickname for Avraham Sharir. And Sharir ultimately does come back, and a cabinet is able to be formed on a coalition of 62 members. But this was tense times. It took 42 days for Shamir to put it all together. A lot of horse trading. Now, the public became aware of all this horse trading. And they realized that there were promises being made to minor parties that really should never be made in a legitimate democracy. I mean, individual MKs were being given deputy ministerships and all sorts of perks and cars and who knows what, bodyguards, and parties were being given billions of dollars. A lot of shenanigans. So the Supreme Court, because of a lawsuit put forth by the citizenry, the Supreme Court issued a ruling saying that all coalition agreements with individual MKs and with parties must be made public and can no longer be kept under seal and kept private. Now, that would seem like an obvious thing that should have been the law of the land from day one. That it wasn't and required a Supreme Court decision goes to show you how Israel is a very much an imperfect democracy and trying to get better, but it's got a long way to go. All right. So, the new government is established June of 1990. And it's the most right-wing government in Israel's history. The most right-wing ever.
How right-wing is it really? Very, very.
Let's look at the players who were involved. Shamir is the prime minister. The defense minister is now Moshe Arens. The foreign minister is David Levy. Most of the lesser ministers are members of the Likud. And now who joins the government? Techiya and Moledet, the real far right. The only one who's not in is Kahana, because he was, well, out of Knesset, because he was kicked out and then later dead. But basically, all the right-wing players have seats at this coalition table. And Somit, too, Raful Eitan. So, what happens now? Shamir is hoping that there's a distraction, that he's not forced to the negotiating table with Arab partners, which he doesn't really want to do. He needs a big distraction. And what's the biggest possible distraction?
War.
War. Okay, so Saddam Hussein does everybody a favor, and on August 2nd, 1990, invades Kuwait, and Operation Desert Shield. And then January 15th, 1991, the night the Giants beat the 49ers in the NFC Championship game, I was at the Concord Hotel. War breaks out. Operation Desert Storm. Okay? Well, during wartime, America is distracted and cannot be busy pressuring Israel to make concessions. Although, that didn't stop Baker from making nasty comments. Baker famously in 1990 said, after an unpleasant episode with Shamir, here's the White House telephone number, call us when you're serious about peace. And that was seen as a little shtach to Shamir. So, Israel has a big problem in Desert Storm. Does it respond to Scud attacks? Shamir was being pressured by Bush to do nothing. Shamir was being pressured by Tichia, Somet, Moledet, elements within the Likud, and even some elements on the left side of the aisle to respond with military force to Iraqi provocation. Ultimately, he decides to do nothing. Why? So a few factors. Number one, the Patriot missile batteries were supposedly going to defend Israel from Scud attacks. As it turned out, they did more harm than good, because the Scuds were imprecise and the Patriot missiles caused a lot of shrapnel and damage. But people didn't know that at the time, they only knew it afterwards. The other factor is, you want to be on America's good side, because Shamir knew that we can't alienate the world's last superpower. The Soviet Union was disintegrating at that very moment. And without a balance of forces in the world of the Cold War, with America favoring the Jews and the Ruskies favoring the Arabs, if it's a unipolar world of America, you can't annoy America too much. You got to keep on your good side. So he has to throw Bush a bone, and the non-participation in the war meant that Bush owed him a favor. What is this favor going to look like? What's the favor going to look like? Well,
arms.
Mostly money and arms. It means money for the settling of Russian Jews in Israel. Israel has a massive housing shortfall because the population one day is 3 million, the next day is 4 million. You got to house these people. So they need American money, financial aid, military aid, and loan guarantees. Okay? So this becomes a real political football. America, under Bush and Baker, say, we'll give you these loan guarantees on condition for a settlement freeze in the territories. And Shamir says no. As it was, the left side of the aisle in Israel had long complained that money was being spent on the territories, on isolated settlements, millions and millions of dollars, that should have been spent in Israel proper, and that the economy was suffering, and housing issues were worse than they could have been because of Likud ideology, because of Eretz Yisrael HaShlema ideology, were actually hurting the country in a material sense. So now, add another layer on top of that, you're hurting Israel in a diplomatic political sense because we can't get access to the cash in international bond markets unless we do the smart thing and curtail our activities in the West Bank and Gaza. So this was a legitimate criticism of Shamir, emanating from not just the far left, but even in the center, even in part of the Likud. Okay. Well, Shamir thought that he would benefit from his behavior during the Gulf War. But promises were made and promises weren't kept. And the Bush administration, by the middle of 1991, by the summer, and certainly by the fall of 1991, no longer took into consideration Shamir's good behavior 6 months earlier. So, and by the way, this is an important lesson, that Israel doesn't benefit in the long run from conciliatory gestures. Like, for example, in 2001, your average Westerner remembered that Ehud Barak gave away the store at Camp David No. 2. By 2005, that was ancient history, and by 2017, that's in the Stone Age. Okay, so in 1991, a similar thing. Good behavior by the Israeli Prime Minister, but it's very quickly forgotten. Now, Shamir did have a political diplomatic success in the fall of 91 with Madrid. The Madrid conference, which met in late October of 91, was not something that Shamir wanted to do. It was that international conference that Peres had always wanted, that Rabin and Shamir had long feared, and everyone on the right side of the aisle in Israel said, well, we don't really want to go to these things because they're just going to bully us into a corner and force major concessions from us. So why did Shamir agree to go? Well, again, the Americans are breathing down his neck. He has to do something. But also, the Americans gave in. They caved in to many of Shamir's demands. What were those demands? First of all, no PLO. Second of all, no distinct Palestinian delegation, but rather a joint Palestinian-Jordanian delegation. So I don't know if you remember from 28 years ago from Madrid, but that was a big deal at the time. It was a joint Palestinian-Jordanian. The relevance of that is it brings Jordan back into the fold as a relevant actor in the Israeli-Arab conflict that can help resolve the conflict, and that there's no such thing as Palestine or the Palestinians. It's all one big hodgepodge. Okay, the other factor was that the agenda was limited, and certain sensitive issues like Jerusalem were not going to be discussed. And then maybe most importantly, it was a promise of a two-stage process, of an international conference to start off with all the world powers being physically present at the table, but afterwards those world powers becoming irrelevant and bilateral negotiations being the primary method. And that's what Israel had always wanted, bilateral and not multilateral.
All this time there was never a question of direct negotiation?
The Arabs had long refused. The Syrians refused to sit at the same table as an Israeli for 40 years. Even in 1973, when Abba Ibn went to Geneva, the Syrians didn't show up because he couldn't sit at the same table with him. It's like in Parsha, it's like in Bereishis, chapter 43, where Mitzrayim can't sit with the Ivrim because it's a Tohu Vahi Mitzrayim. Okay, so Tohu Vahi Surya, they can't sit with a Jew. Well, this was Madrid. Now, Shamir goes there. And if you remember the footage, it was Shamir and his right-hand men, Yossi Ben Aaron with a big knitted yarmulke. There was a lot of religious Zionist representation and, you know, hawkish figures at Madrid. What did they do? They listened to Shamir give a speech outlining 45 years of conflict from an Israeli and right-wing Zionist perspective, and a man who had a glum look on his face, like, this is going nowhere, I know it and you know it, but I'm forced to be here, so here's my story. Now, when you come in with that attitude, what's the end result? Nothing happens. And that's perfectly fine for Shamir. He was just treading water. So if you're an Israeli who wants a real peace process, you see through this right away. You see he's just treading water. He's not advancing the ball at all. And if you're a right-winger who wants the territories and hell and peace be damned, you think, go for it, you know, he's socking it to him. Well, late in the term, Shamir's coalition hits a rough patch. First of all, Tzomet resigns. Why does Tzomet resign? Because of the Likud violating a promise it made regarding electoral reform, which we'll speak about in a minute. Then, Tehiya and Moledet left the government over the Madrid process, that even though Shamir knew it was a farce, he couldn't say so explicitly, but in his heart he knew it was a farce, that's not good enough. The real hard right says, even a farce we will not tolerate with. You know, Kal Vachomer, real peace process, but even a farce, we will not go along with that. We're out. Okay, so they made a big mistake, a big blunder. Maybe the biggest blunder in Israeli political history was that of the hard right to leave that government. Because what do? You open up the possibility of a new election and a victory by the other side of the aisle. And then what happens to you? You're a nobody who's a settler lunatic in the opposition, as opposed to being minister of whatever affairs. So they made a big, big mistake, the far right, in late 91, early 92. Now, why did Tzomet leave the government over electoral reform? This is an important topic that is of still relevance today. Tzomet was a good government party, and it was founded by Raful Eitan, who was really a left-winger by social background, a socioeconomic background, a moshavnik, a kibbutznik type. He came from the left, but he had hard-right views on matters of war and peace. And in Israel of the late 80s, early 90s, your economic perspective doesn't really mean anything anymore. The only thing that matters is your view on the territories and view on war and peace. So therefore, he becomes a right-winger, a hard right-winger. But he believes in good government, in clean government, in honest government. And he was appalled by how Likud was basically totally corrupt by the late 80s, early 90s. And he wanted direct election of prime minister. So a bill was put forth, jointly sponsored by a member of Tzomet, by a member of Labor, by a member of Likud, a member of Shinui, for direct election of prime minister. And the Labor Party favored it, and the Likud Party was instinctively against it. And Tzomet and Eitan had extracted a promise from Shamir that party discipline would not be invoked for the Likud when it comes to voting on this issue. Now, what is party discipline?
You have to vote
the way that the boss of the party says. There's no, you know, split the difference. Everybody must vote a certain way.
Party line
vote. And so there was supposed to be no party discipline on this vote, everyone voting their conscience. In the end, it didn't happen. The Likud voted against. Now, the vote was ultimately successful in a revised format, and there would be direct election of the Prime Minister by the mid-1990s. But Somit was angry over having been betrayed. Now, let me ask you a question. Why was Labour in favor of direct election, and why was Likud opposed? There are several reasons, but one really important reason. Think about it.
Labour had people with charisma in it?
Think about who lives in Israel. Who lives in Israel? What two groups live in Israel? No.
Rich and poor.
Huh?
Israelis and Arabs.
Jews and Arabs. Bingo. Okay. So when Arabs vote in Israeli elections, and yes, there over the years there have been differences and it fluctuates with time, but basically about half or slightly more than half vote for Arab parties. The other half votes for Zionist parties, Jewish parties, whether Labour or the NRP or even Shas for whatever reason. You know, the Arab vote is kind of funny, and they split it around, but about half of it goes for Arab parties, or the Communist Party, which is basically an Arab party. So the Arab votes that go for Arab parties have absolutely no bearing on what?
On the prime minister.
Correct. Because Arab parties are never included in a coalition. So it's very difficult for the... let's put that aside for a second. But because their votes don't affect the outcome of who wins, it means that you need to win a majority of the Jewish vote and then some if you want to become prime minister. What happens if you have direct election? Which side of the aisle are the Arabs going to vote for? The side that's more conciliatory to the Palestinians and to Arab Israelis, which means the left side of the aisle. Because when Labour wins, there's a peace process with the PLO, or whomever, and when Labour wins, who else joins the government? All those far-left citizens' rights parties that are worried about what? They're the Israeli version of the ACLU. They care about minorities, the Arabs, okay, that the Arabs shouldn't be pushed around by the Jews. So the Arabs want a left-of-center government, but they can only vote for it with any degree of effectiveness if there is direct election of prime minister, because then they can vote for Khadash or Balad or Ramtal or Ahmed, whoever, Tibi, and still determine who's prime minister of Israel. Okay, so why does Likud oppose it? For that very reason. So long as there is no direct election, what has to happen? The left side of the aisle has to win a massive, not plurality, but majority of the Jewish vote if they ever hope to win. And they can't. So the right has a distinct advantage. Okay. Also, another factor. The Likud can comfortably rely upon its coalition partners in the religious world to join with them in forming a government, even though the voters didn't pull the lever or put the slip in the box for Likud. They put it in for Degla Torah or Aguda or Shas, whomever. And it's a done deal. We don't have to worry about it. As opposed to the other side of the aisle, the left side of the aisle, who can't rely upon that. They can only hope to win in the existing system with basically secular left of center or center parties putting forth 61 MKs, which is never, hardly ever happens and hasn't happened in the last 30 years more than one time. So direct election really benefits the left side of the aisle and hurts the right side of the aisle. Another factor, specific to 1992. Direct election means an American-style presidential campaign. You need to have a good candidate, a compelling story. Who's more likable, Yitzhak Shamir or a generic labor leader? Generic labor leader. Who's now, of the two labor leaders who are possible, Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin, so let's now compare Shamir to Peres. Well, it's a draw. We don't like him. But compare Yitzhak Rabin to Yitzhak Shamir, and all of a sudden you have a war hero who is coming on strong and has had a long and illustrious record against a 77-year-old guy who's has better days, if they ever existed, were behind him.
Came from the shtetl.
Right. So it's another reason why Labor wants direct election, and Likud is very much opposed to it. But ultimately, the bill is passed. There is going to be direct election. With one caveat, it will not begin in 1992. It will begin the next cycle. So that is very often the case with constitutional change. Like in America, you know, Harry Truman could have run for another term because the law didn't apply to him. He chose not to run for another term. But you delay it so that you're not affecting a specific person who's the incumbent. Okay. That was one major constitutional change Israel did in early 1992. There was another one. On the last day of functioning of that Knesset, in March of 92, the threshold was raised from 1.1% to 1.5%, which means you can no longer have a faction of one seat, a minimum of two seats. This is a very important change, which is exacerbated by the rapid increase in the number of Israeli citizens between 1990 and 1992. With the arrival of Russian Aliyah, so now 1.1% in 1988 was 22,000 votes. 1.5% in 1992 was 40,000 votes. I mean, it's a tremendous difference. So if you're like a boutique party that only has a limited constituency, you might find yourself below the threshold just because there aren't that many people who like your ideas. Okay, and that would happen to a certain very important party in the 92 election, which we'll talk about next time. Okay, so now in the few minutes we have left, let's talk about the beginnings of the 1992 election cycle. Well, the Labor Party decides we need to turn it over to the people. We cannot have the smoke-filled room determining who our leader is. We need to have primaries. Primaries. And in fact, in Israel, in early 92, the word on the street was not Bechira Mukdemet, which is the official Hebrew word for primary. What were they using? Primary. Pei, Reish, Yud, Yud, Mem, whatever. They were using the word English word primary. Now, it didn't hurt that there were primaries going on in the United States at the same time. And a boy from Arkansas was about to rise to the top and become president. So this 1992 election, even though direct election of prime minister formally did not begin until 1996, the Labor Party wanted to treat it as though it were a direct election, which means pick a leader by popular acclaim and run under the banner of that leader as Miflegat Avoda Birashut, fill in the blank. The Labor Party under the leadership of, well, who's it going to be? So Peres runs against Rabin again, and Rabin finally wins. Why does he finally win? Well, first of all, Peres was never all that popular among the masses. And so once you open it up to a wider audience of voting voters, Rabin has a better chance. But also, people were disgruntled with four election cycles in which Shimon never got the job done. 1977, 1981, 1984, 1988. How many times do you want to give a guy before you say goodbye?
What job was he supposed to have gotten done?
He was supposed to have outright won an election, and the results were not good. In 77, he lost 43-32. In 81, he lost 48-47. In 84, he theoretically won 44-41, but couldn't form a coalition, therefore only got a rotation. And in 1988, he lost 40-39. So with that kind of a record, pick somebody else. I mean, Menachem Begin lost 8 times, but Menachem Begin was the head of a small faction of ex-terrorists. The fact that he didn't win until 29 years later, it's because when you start at the bottom, you have to build yourself up. But when you're a formerly governing party and you lose 4 times in a row, it's enough. So Rabin wins, and he wants to run a strong campaign de-emphasizing the undercard. Now, why de-emphasize the undercard? Because who votes in a primary? Ideologically driven people. So if it's a right-wing party, you get Mike Huckabee. And if it's a left-wing party, you get Elizabeth Warren. So in the 1982 standards for labor, it meant getting people who were known doves, Peace Now types. Okay, the Yossi Beilins of the world. And that's not going to be a winning ticket if you want, you know, to get to form the governing coalition. So therefore, don't focus on anybody else. Just focus on Rabin. There's something else that works in Rabin's favor. It's 1992. That's an anniversary. What anniversary is it? Christopher Columbus, 500 years, but something a little bit more recent than 500 years. 1992 is an anniversary of 25 years since?
82,
the Six-Day War. Okay, and the election is happening in June of 92. So all the 25th anniversary celebrations, which are going to involve the still-living heroes of that war, and Yitzhak Rabin was the chief of staff during that war, and Mote Gur is still alive and was Harbayt Bi'adenu and is on the labor ticket. So all the celebratory events are going to have to include a candidate running for office. So they actually had a problem. And because of legalities, they actually had to have Rabin absent himself from some certain of the formal events. But the Labor Party ran private events, not run by the state, which served the same purpose, that the hero of the 1967 Six-Day War is now our candidate for prime minister.
Did they have an equal time type provision in Israel?
Yes. For public television and radio, you had a set amount of minutes based upon how many seats you have in the Knesset, and so you couldn't fool around with that. But cable TV was becoming popular, and the rules didn't apply on cable, or the rules were not exactly the same on cable. All right. So Labor has Rabin, Berashuto shel Rabin. He's the focus, 25th anniversary of the Six-Day War. But also something else. Rabin was seen, correctly so, as not being a super dove, as being someone who's strong on security and will be tough on the Arabs, but who's interested in making peace. So he has he's chazak, like a Shamir type, with the record to prove it, but sincerely interested in a political diplomatic accommodation. So if you're a centrist voter, that's an attraction. Also, Rabin never lost an election. You know Rabin never lost an election in his life? Because he only ran in one election. The man was prime minister twice and was a leader of a party, or a top two leader of the party, for 20 years. But he only actually ran in one election. And what was that? 1992. He didn't run in 73, 74. Golda ran, and Golda resigned, and he took over for her. He didn't run in 77 because of Leah Rabin's bank account. And he didn't run in 96 because Yigal Amir killed him. So he only ran one time, despite a long, illustrious career at the top of a major party. And he's a winner. Okay, so that's what Labor has going for it. So we'll stop here. And next time we'll discuss, what does Likud have going for it? Because Likud's defeat in 1992 would shock many people. They would regard it as another mahapach, another revolution. But maybe we should have seen it coming. We'll stop there.